extra time is exactly how I find out what's going on in the MLS.
Get lost. Get lost.
Maybe this podcast has influenced me a little bit as well.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory, to try to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
That's why he's here.
From New York, New York, you are listening to Extra Time. I am Andrew Wiebe with my partner in soccer. Matt Doyle is here. Match day 27 is in the books. It's a Thursday morning. We're a little bit tired. So is Pablo Mastroeni, who will join us in just a little bit. Doyle, big show. We're going to wrap up everything that went down on Wednesday night. It was a big night in the Shield race. Miami were the big winners. We're going to talk about the ding, 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 ding. Rule changes that are finally here when it comes to roster construction. They're in effect for the transfer window that opened, ding, 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 today, July 18th. So if you don't have some sort of ding, 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 some sort of announcement on Tom Bogert's Twitter feed, I pity you. That should be something that you get done right now while you listen. What's up, Doyle? How you doing?
Well, I want to say that in one of the discords that I'm in with Tom, he sent a message at 2 a.m. saying that he had to stop himself from tweeting breaking news at 2 a.m. And I think he did that for all the people who do have notifications on, because 2 a.m. is too late in the night or too early in the morning to be woken up by breaking news, even from Tom, even in this silliest of MLS seasons.
It's just not the right time. Like, I get it, Tom. You're trying to crush the competition. You want to be the big dog, the hot dog, so to speak, in this situation. But nobody else is working. Nobody else is chasing that news. Nobody else is thinking about tweeting it at 2 a.m. So just wait till we wake up on the East Coast. Your engagement will be better as well. It's going to be a busy window. As I said, there are new rules. Prime spots may now be utilized by MLS teams, six of them. Whether that's two DPs and four U22s plus some GAM, which we talked about on the show before, or three DPs and three U22s and no GAM, Doyle and I will take you through all of that. Plus, you'll hear from Pablo Mastroeni as we prepare for Rocky Mountain Cup on Saturday. You can watch that on MLS Season Pass at 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time. And before we get into the best thing you saw, what's the best MLS Archive Collection jersey you saw? Just to draw the ire of all the clubs who didn't get one, but I'm sure will in the future, folks. Like, I'm pretty sure you're going to get that.
I mean, we were having the discussion last night in the green room, and it's ridiculous because Miami's been around for 5 years.
Boo.
So they don't have a
Johnny come lately. Sort no of history.
History. But that third kit is, it's awesome. It's freaking awesome. It just like embodies everything that, like the neon, the font, the Miami third kit is great. Like, to be fair though, I thought all five of them are really good. The Galaxy one is absolutely superb. The Miami one is a cut above.
And we're gonna see it everywhere. Look, the success of these begets more success. For those out there that are frustrated that their team does not have an archive jersey this season, I completely get it. I understand. The reason that jealousy exists in that sense is because they're sick, and I hope that every club gets them and every fan base over the next few years is rocking them. But in the meantime, get ready to see that Miami jersey literally everywhere. Like, there is not a place you can go on this earth right now that you are not going to get hit by a Miami pink Messi jersey. I mean, it is just, it's ubiquitous. Even my four-year-old, like, if you ask him about soccer, he will talk to you about Messi for like 10 minutes. This kid doesn't watch soccer games. He just hears his brother talk about it. It like somehow gets into his world somehow. I guess he lives in this household.
I thought you turned them into Red Bulls fans last year.
Yeah, it doesn't stick as long as you think it might. They haven't been back to a game. So now my older son's an Argentina fan, Doyle. Like, if you think Lionel Messi is not ruling the minds of the young, you're out of your mind.
Running Cameron a household
Wiebe,
of
Cameron Wiebe claims Argentina. It just makes no sense, but it's fun all the same. The other note here. Marko Mitrovic will be with us in a little bit. I talked to him earlier this week. So U.S. Olympics kick off in, I think a little bit more than a week at this point. But Marco talks through his selections on the roster, what they want to do with the tournament, and what comes next for this Olympic side that's the first in many, many years. Okay, rewind, Doyle. Deep breath. I've got a little excitable here. Whew, okay, best thing you saw midweek. What do you got?
No one loves to say I told you so the way I love to say I told you so. And when it comes to playing Martin Ojeda as a number 10 for Orlando City, I freaking told you so. Like, as soon as it was as soon as it was clear in the winter that they weren't going to go out Orlando City and spend big on a true number 10, I think the obvious thing was to move Ojeda there. And granted, he had played most of his time in Argentina as a winger, but most isn't all. And in the time, I think about 25% that he was in Argentina, he played about 25% of his minutes as a number 10. And when he was playing there, his chance creation numbers were somewhere around the 96th percentile. I'm talking like, you know, expected assists, key passes per 90, the whole suite of stuff you would look at for a number 10. And for whatever reason, even after the kid had 11 assists, primarily as a super sub in his debut season in MLS in 2023, Oscar Pereja just refused to play him as a number 10, tried just about everybody else on the roster in that spot. And over the past, I think, seven games, Ojeda has now been primarily a number 10 as the team's played a 4-2-3-1. It allows Facu Torres to play on one wing. It allows Ivan Angulo to play on the other wing. It allows either Duncan Maguire or Ramiro Enrique, notably not Luis Muriel, to start up top as the number 9. It allows both Wilder Cartagena and Cesar Araujo to play deep in midfield. It allows both fullbacks to get forward. In the first 17 games of this season, Orlando City scored 17 goals. Since the switch, last seven games, they have scored 21 goals, including a big 3-0 win last night. The first two goals came off of set pieces, perfect deliveries from Martin Ojeda. They're just a much better team. It works in the way I think that the front office thought it would work. And hopefully the preponderance of evidence and data is so unassailable at this point that Oscar Pereja cannot change it for the worse. And it's weird to say that because Oscar Pereja has been such a good coach in this league for so long, but he had some kind of block about playing this guy in the obvious spot, and that block has been beaten down. And Orlando City are now, I think, fifth in the East on points per game.
Five wins in their last six, Doyle.
Yeah.
Dare I read out the opponents to you on those five wins?
I'm sorry, they're seventh on points per game. Yes, not the best. They weren't facing murderers.
Let me just do it. Right. Chicago at home, at Toronto, when Toronto have been just down bad. DC at home, at New England, at Nashville. Nashville have lost five straight. So, hey, it's good. They're rising up the table. Orlando City desperately needed this, but there is still something to be proved here. New York City at home is their final game before League's Cup break, and they have not been as good at home, so that's a big one to make a point against their expansion brethren. As for me, Kevin Sullivan and the Union. Best thing I saw by far, the debut of Kevin Sullivan, 14 years, 200 and something days old. I mean, it is not very many. That is the point here, folks. He is the youngest player to play in a first division major league in the United States. Younger than Freddie Adu by 13 days. Freddie Adu was out here like live tweeting this, Doyle. Freddie is very active on social media. He's got some takes, and I'm really enjoying it. But Kevin got in late. He got to see his brother, Quinn Sullivan, his older brother, bang a golazo. The Union won, 5-1, I think it was, in the end. And they had a night of reprieve from the misery that has been the 2024 season. A home win, Doyle. That beer garden they built that looks absolutely gorgeous has got like no use because there's nothing to celebrate. I hope it was popping last night. I hope the Sullivans rolled through there to see the entire family on the field getting pictures, to see what it meant to the brothers, to do it together, and just to see this, I mean, prodigy get his start. That is so special. And the whole story just sort of anchors it for me in the sense that Kevin Sullivan, he is a Philly kid. On the postgame show, they asked him, like, what's your goals for the rest of the season? Very easy for him to focus on himself. He talked exclusively about making the playoffs and getting the Union back to where they want it. Because remember, this dude's a fan. His brother played for the team before he did. His dad is in the academy. He's lived and breathed it. That, to me, is like the epitome of the homegrown story that you're trying to grow in a laboratory. They're not all going to be like this, and rightfully so, and they don't have to be. But this one is just – the night was perfect.
It was. Other than his first touch – which was terrible.
Yeah, come on. You know,
you can't have it all.
But that's a good joke for his brothers to hold on to for the rest of their lives, in addition to the fact that Quinn scored in his debut.
It might be the only thing his brothers ever are able to hold over him, because it's fair to get excited about Gavin Sullivan. And we have a habit as a soccer society, as a soccer country, and I think every country has this probably to one degree or another, of getting too excited about the young kids coming through. I think I told this story last year on this program, maybe three or four years ago, a buddy of mine who really follows youth national team players said, you have to check out this highlight tape of this Kevin Sullivan kid. It's so good. And I, as a rule, I do not watch highlight compilations of youth players, because by definition, it's just the highlights, right? You're only seeing the good. You're not seeing it in context of a larger game. But it was, for whatever reason, I put it on. It's 26 minutes. I'm like, there's no way. I'll watch 30 seconds of this. I watched the full 26-minute highlight reel of this kid. He must have been 10 at the time. I watched the full 26-minute reel, and then I sat down and I watched it again. And what I saw in that one was, all the special first touch and tricks and like dribbling skills that you look for. But he also showed a real understanding of spacing. Real understanding of not just where the pressure was coming from, but how to manipulate that pressure and use his gravity as a special player to open up space for the kids around him. And he was showing this as a 10-year-old. And he got on the field last night. He only got, 12 minutes last night. Even in that 12 minutes, you could see his understanding of space. His soccer IQ is off the charts for a 14-year-old, and more than merely adequate for a professional player. The way he moves off the ball is not something that I think Freddie Adu was ever taught before he got to MLS, whereas this kid has that before he played an MLS minute. He even showed good signs defensively, which you have to. If you're going to play for the Union, you have to understand pressing angles. And as a 14-year-old, he's showing that. If he develops into the type of athlete that his older brother Quinn is, and Quinn is not a break the charts type of run jump athlete, but he's a very good athlete and with an incredible motor. If Kevin hits those numbers, then the Manchester City purchase agreement will come to fruition in a way that is an incredible bargain for Man City, an incredible feather in the cap of the Philadelphia Union as a developmental soccer team.
Credit to the Union, credit more so, I'd say, even to Kevin Sullivan himself and his family and the environment Absolutely. That they've built. Like, wow. He's at the perfect club in the perfect place, I think, to spend these years of his life in both a comfortable situation in terms of the people around him, but also in one where he will clearly be challenging himself at a level that nobody else has challenged themselves at this age. So, awesome. Last thing here for me on best thing, I would be remiss if I did not mention that FC Dallas is now tweeting things like, quote, "It wouldn't be Dollar Glizzy Night without Logan, quote, Big Dog, quote, Hot Dog Farrington," with a video of Logan Farrington passing out hot dogs from the container that holds the cowboy hat that's given to the best player on FC Dallas after every win at home. It is everything I could have hoped and dreamed of. I would like to retire the Hot Dog Farrington nickname. It has served its time well. It was the beginning of this. He is now Big Dog Farrington. FC Dallas has decreed, and I will follow their lead. Big Dog Farrington is playing real well, Doyle. The Shield race is crazy. The race for fourth in both conferences is crazy. Playoff survival is on. We're headed into League's Cup. It's been a great season, so we got some changes. Transfer window rules announced today, July 18th, the first open day of the MLS transfer window for all teams. Of course, it opened earlier for the Canadian teams. I sort of laid it out before, but we'll do it again. There is now more flexibility in how teams use quote-unquote prime spots, being DP spots and U22 spots. There is still a maximum of 6 spots, but you can allocate it differently now. For one, there's no limit if you have 3 DPs, senior DPs that is, non-young DPs or tamable DPs, on how many of those players can now be U22s. You can have 6, 3 and 3 or 2 and 4. However you want to do it, you'll also now get more money when you sell players, more GAM to be collected if you earn that based on acquisition fees. It's up to $3 million now. So big changes, Doyle. What's it all mean?
I think more flexibility, both for the teams themselves and for the overall conception of how to build a winning roster in MLS. We were trying to brand it before the show. We'll peel back the curtain and show our listeners our process here.
The process.
We were just trying to brand it. Like, one is very clearly like the star power build. If you're choosing three DPs, three, you know, senior DPs and three U22 signings, like the whole point of it is we got to get those three super elite players in. And if you're choosing the other way, we call the developmental path, like you're going to have two, hopefully, elite DPs and then four of the U22 signings. But then you also get $2 million worth in allocation cash that you could throw at guys making, what, like $1.7
million? Yeah.
Or
you could accumulate, quote unquote, TAM players. You could basically expand your cap,
yeah,
so to speak, with that game. Let's call it the developmentally flexible cap. No, that's the path. I mean, look, it is development, but you would think, given some of the transfer fees on U22s and the way some of those players have played in this league, plus your ability to go get more TAM players or expand your cap, that it is also flexibility in including developmental. Like, it starts now. Teams will have to establish at the end of the window basically which path they're going on and to get into roster compliance, essentially. There are teams that will go one way or already are going one way and can add one player or two player. There are teams that can make wholesale changes because of this. There are teams that have already sort of used it. And like, you know, Houston, since, for instance, they went out and got a U22 winger after signing another senior DP in Ponce. Who does this help the most right now if you look around the league?
I mean, initially, I think it helps Nashville because this was a team that was kind of locked into their roster, which, you know, with three guys making quite a bit of money in Mukhtar, Zimmerman, and Surridge, and none of them coming off the books for years. And they're a team that's fighting for a spot in the playoffs and had no actual way to improve their roster. And it's a roster that has, I think, two big needs in midfield ball progression and a more dynamic center forward presence, especially if Sam Surridge is going to be playing on the left wing, which it looks like is going to be his long-term home. By opening up two U22 slots, they have the ability to add a dynamic ball progressor and hopefully a more dynamic center forward. And to that end, have they announced the Australian kid that they've been rumored to?
I don't think so. Patrick Yazbek is the name that's not just been floating around. It's basically been like chiseled in stone. It seems pretty certainly that he will be arriving shortly. So from Australia. Yeah,
he's from Australia. I think he was playing in Norway the past couple of years, has really good numbers there. Our guy Ben Wright has done a lot of digging on him and crushed a lot of film. Like, he looks like a really good player who they will hopefully be able to drop into that lineup and help address some of the issues that have turned perennially very good Nashville side into dog water for most of this season. So like, they're just off the jump, that is a team, and they are locked into the 3 and 3 path, right? Like, they have Surridge, Zimmerman, and Mukhtar under contract at big numbers for at least the next 2 years, I think maybe even longer than that. So opening this up, Nashville has a lifeline.
Huge. It's two high-level, high-investment spots in U22 to go after with BJ Callahan, who has a reputation of maybe being more of a guy who would develop players for you as well. I'll just say this before we sort of go down the path a little bit more. I just think you're going to see a lot of quote-unquote DPs that have really just been tamable players who have been placeholders there for U22 spots or for cap purposes. I think a lot of those guys are going to go away from the DP status. You're going to see more U22 spots used because more are available to teams. You don't have to say, okay, well, we have to have a young DP or this guy. We can't have three full designated players, even if we want them. It just provides a little bit more flexibility. I will also add, if I had my druthers, I would just say, hey, let's have 6 prime spots. Use them however you want to use them under the cap, and everybody gets $2 million in GAM. Like, that's what I would want to see. I just think I'd say flexibility.
Let's have 10, but yeah, like, yeah.
Sure. But as it stands, this is a good addition midseason to give teams the opportunity to go make real changes and to add to their teams and chase something this year in addition to the future. Real quick, before we move on to transfers, who's the biggest impact already through the doors? That's a question we're asking ourselves. I would throw Houston into that mix. I think the state of Texas overall is going to get a big boost, and it needs it. Houston with Ponce and then Anali, he's the winger they brought in from Poland, who, I mean, you said in the early meeting, he's kind of on a Hani Mukhtar path, like was in Germany, was at some bigger clubs, didn't quite work out, got to Poland, got his career going, and now Houston are seeing if he can add a 1v1 presence for them on the wing. And then Austin, Osman Bukhari, and then the center back and the right back they're getting from Europe as well. And I would throw in St. Louis. There's a bunch of teams that have made their moves already. Who would you be watching on this front?
I love the Houston shout because we love their midfield. And they proved it earlier this year without Ace Ace. Well, Ace Ace has been back and he's been really good. Coco Karaskia is still in town and it looks like they're going to keep him through the end of this season. I love their defense. Mikhail, you know, arguably in the Defender of the Year race. They still need, I think, to add another attacking left back. So Tate Schmidt is getting healthy. To your point, though, we've said if they get the right center forward and they get a goal-scoring winger in there, this is a team that could jump a couple levels and be, like, serious MLS Cup threats. Well, they made the Ponce signing, and everybody I know in Europe was like, he's going to be great in MLS. And then Anali, I haven't heard as much about, but if you look at his profile and what he is, it seems like Pat Noonan and that front office did amazing work. And look, because of the
Pat Onstad,
Pat Onstad and the front office did amazing work. The other thing is, like, this is a 3-3 team now. Unless they trade Sebas Ferreira, which they very well could, this is a team with three official DPs and three U22 guys, and they might not have been able to be that if this new rule didn't come through. But for all,
can I add one thing on that? And that their future is more flexible too, because if they move Sebas Ferreira, they could decide, okay, actually we have a perfect target to come in and be a senior DP. We're going to stick 3-3. Or at that moment, they could make a switch in the winter and say, actually, I think we're going to switch this up, going 2-4, and then have 2 million in GAM. Like, you can sort of tailor it around targets, budget, where you think you're going, how players are developing, where sales are going to occur. I mean, it's huge. It's huge.
It's really good. All that said, Olivier Giroud is one of the best center forwards of the past 15 years. He's still good enough to be a French international. We saw him, you know, at the Euros this past month. He is not just a goal scorer. He is a ceiling raiser for the guys around him. Like, he's made a career out of making the other attackers on his team 15% better because he's so smart about occupying defenders, dragging them around, and creating gaps for his wingers to exploit. And, oh, yeah, his wingers are Dennis Bouanga and Mateus Bogush and Kike Oliveira. And, like, those guys are really, really, really good.
David Martinez, too, who also is really
finally getting some minutes. Yeah, so it's, like, Giroud is a home run of a signing. And the way LAFC have structured their roster, they're going to be a 2-4 team, which is interesting because we think of LAFC as a Miami or a Galaxy-style approach to roster building. But Denny Bouanga and Giroud are going to be the only true DPs, and they're going to have access to all four U22 slots and then an extra 2 million of GAM on top of that, which for a team that has done amazing work in MLS free agency over the past couple of years, that is a significant roster building advantage for them.
And that's why they're in the Big Six. We've so branded it: Cincinnati, Miami, LAFC, Real Salt Lake, LA Galaxy, and the Crew, all fighting for the Shield, all jockeying for position. Wednesday was another big night in the race. Miami came out, I mean, as the big winners. There's no doubt that without Messi, without Suarez, getting 5 wins in 6 and staying on top of the Shield, that's incredible. 50 points, Cincinnati right behind them on 48. Things are falling apart right now for Pat Noonan's boys. They need to get to League's Cup break. The Galaxy on 46, LAFC on 44 after a disappointing draw for them with RSL. RSL, it's a good draw. We'll talk to Pablo in a second. They're on 44. and the Crew dropped points at home to Charlotte on 43 points, but with games in hand. But Miami now control this thing. Even if Columbus went out, they cannot match where this Miami team sits on points per game after 24 games. Some needs here. I'll just run through it quickly. As the window opens, Cincinnati, they got to sign a veteran center back, period. Double period, triple period, that has to happen. I would also say they need to resolve Bupenza's future. I think to get to their highest level, that means moving on. How that happens, not party to that, so we'll see what they do. Miami, David Martinez has been linked to them very strongly. Both Ciel Merlo and Tom Bogut are saying it's going to happen on loan. If you don't know who he is, 26-year-old center back from River Plate in Paraguay. It's a need. They need it. Mystery box for Miami Doyle. I don't know. Chris Henderson could brew up anything, and I would believe it.
I got to tell you, I'm looking at Cincinnati's roster, their salary cap numbers for all their players right now. If they can buy out Bupenza, they're going to be a 2-4 team. They're not going to be a team with three-star level DPs. I think they're going to be a team with two of those. And I think they, specifically because I think the GAM, the $2 million worth of GAM that they get, buys down guys like Miles Robinson, Matt Miazga, Yuya Kubo, Abina Nwobodo, Sergio Santos.
GAM. Oh, GAM. Sorry. LAFC need to integrate Giroud and sign a central midfielder. This is beautiful, though. This is what this opens up. This flexibility just it changes the way we can talk about this stuff.
Yeah,
RSL got to sign.
I'm going to plug. I wrote a couple of columns. They're on the website now. Eastern Conference and Western Conference transfer needs, and I sort of blew it up a little bit into like overall roster status for these teams. And I think a lot of the stuff we're talking about here, you can maybe find in those columns too.
Oh, good plug. Good plug, Kalen. Well done. Real Salt Lake signed a DP number 10. Got to get it done. I talked to Pablo about that, so we'll learn more about that in the interview coming up. The Galaxy seem very close, according to Tom, to signing Marco Royce. They need a backup nine. Maybe he is sort of that nine, and you're rotating all of those pieces, whether it be Payne still going up there, or Ricky as a false nine, or Marco as a false nine. TBD there, but it seems like Jovalich alone with Miguel Berry behind is not exactly the depth that they're looking for. And then the Crew, they can do things, Doyle. They have flexibility on this roster. I just don't know how much they will do. Marino Hinestrosa seems like he'll go on loan to Colombia. And they've already signed Dylan Chambost and AZ Jackson, so they've sort of addressed some depth issues they might have. And yeah, I mean, Zawadzki stepped in, so good to go. How about other teams before we get to this Pablo interview that can change their fortunes the most going forward? Give me one.
The Red Bulls. And the Red Bulls were really close to getting a DP number nine, a young DP number nine over the line back in the winter. They've been linked to Roko Simic, who is a Croatian youth international who was part of the center forward rotation for RB Salzburg this past year, but maybe isn't going to be part of it going forward and needs a little career rehab. I think he'd be a great signing for them. I've mentioned him before, but if it's not him, it has to be someone.
Yeah, cue the more ambition sign right now. Come on, guys.
And the other thing, look, we talked about, I think on Monday, we talked about maybe Eric Williamson being shopped a little bit. He's been excellent the past couple of games for Portland. If he really is being shopped, that's a guy that the Red Bulls should look at because they have a lot of good young players in central midfield. They don't have any veterans. And Eric Williamson at 27, he's a veteran now, and we know that when he's healthy, he's excellent.
I would throw out Charlotte. We've been talking about this for a long time. Karol Swiderski's back in the building. Dean Smith says he's scoring goals for fun and training, and he loves to see that. Can he be the nine? Patrick Agyeman got a goal against the Crew, but I don't think there's any doubt that having just a little bit more efficiency and a different profile up top would be good for them. I go back to the number 10 with Charlotte. I just think they've got to find a way to create more chances for everybody, the wingers and the number nine, and that given their personnel, that would be the position of need, but we'll see if they can do that. I think they can elevate themselves from, oh, hey, I think this team could be in the fourth spot to, oh, hey, maybe they could actually knock off the big dogs in the playoffs. We'll see when that time comes. I'd also just throw out Minnesota. Like, you know, it seems like teams have traded the, oh, woe is us, everything is going wrong situation. And right now Minnesota is wallowing in it. That loss to DC at home was just awful. And Eric Ramsey has got to find his way to pull his team out of this nosedive. Some of the rumors right now around Minnesota and DP spots are uninspiring. I would say. I'm not going to say players' names or anything. I think that maybe that's – it's just – it doesn't fit profiles that you would look at to think that would improve your team greatly in the short or the medium term. But, hey, that's just me. That's just me. All right. Match day 28 is coming up. You can watch, of course, MLS Countdown to get you ready at 6:30 p.m. Eastern time on Saturday. MLS Season Pass on Apple TV. The wrap-up's at 12:30, and MLS 360 is right in between. Doyle and I will be sitting on couches, I assume, on Saturday, watching the games, bantering, and firing out bad takes on Twitter. Pablo Mascherani will be on the sidelines for the Rocky Mountain Cup. Had a nice chat with him this morning. Let's take a listen. It's my pleasure now to welcome Pablo Mascherani to Extra Time, coming to us from a hotel room or conference room in Colorado. Pablo, a massive draw in LA, and you're back on the road again. What's up, man?
How's it going, Andrew? Yeah, it's been a long night, but again, big game coming up in a couple days against our rivals that, again, first two games have been hard fought, and we know what we're up against, and so now it's about turning the page and starting the preparation.
Rocky Mountain Cup for me is the biggest game of the weekend, and we'll get to that in just 1 second. I was sitting here thinking, as I heard in the, you know, we were chatting before, and you're like, okay, well, all these different things are happening as we try to get a flight to get across the country to get to Colorado to play this game. You've been doing this for a long time. What is your road hack, like your travel hack? What gets you through these trips, both as a player and now as a manager?
A lot of it, to be honest, is some alone time and reading. I dive into my room and or on the plane and just kind of get away. You know, I think if you, you know, if you're too obsessed about the game as a player, you build a lot of anxiety and a lot of nerves in preparation. The same as a coach, you know. I think what reading and being alone does for me is allows me to clear my head. And then when I'm in that space, different things come at me, whether it's how to speak to a different individual, how to tackle an issue that we have on the field. So it just gives me space to kind of create. And I think that's really important when travel is so hectic, when the games are coming fast and furious and there's so much on each game.
What is the book that you know you're going to pick up? Like somebody gives you a recommendation, or you're browsing at the bookstore, or you see something come across your path. How do you know that's a book that Pablo Mascherani would want to read?
You know, I usually have three books going at once. Right now I have Programmed to Fail, which is a book about hijacking your subconscious. I have The Biology of Belief, which is an in-depth look at how humans operate, and it's beyond the traditional way of thinking about science and thinking about medicine. It goes into like energy. So, and then the other book is Captain Class, which was it's really, and it's been out for a while, and I just, you know, for whatever reason picked it up. So it's just, it could be football, it could be leadership, could be but a lot of them have to do with like the subconscious, like our purpose on the planet, this type of stuff, and getting into the nuts and bolts of, or trying to find my own connection with what we're doing here on this planet.
Man, let's go deep. But before we go deep, I just got to say, somebody reading three books at the same time, potential psychopath behavior. I'm not saying you are one. I'm just, nah. For me, my brain cannot comprehend that. I'm like a one book at a time guy. I'm locked in. I don't know how you do it.
Well, you know what it is, Andrew? It's more just like, because we all feel different at different parts of the day, or, you know, and it's like, if I'm really into like taking something in, I'll read one of those more esoteric books. If it's more just like interesting, like I'm just kind of tired but want to read something, then it's like a Captain Class.
There you go. Finding your moment. Hey, look, your team found their moment last night in LA against LAFC, a place most teams absolutely do not succeed. And that game against Portland was sort of it wasn't a low point, I would say, but it was maybe lowest performance point that we've seen in a long time. How did you challenge this team before they walked into that stadium in LA, and did they meet that challenge for you?
Yeah, they did. And, you know, we talked about it after the game, and you know, one of our video crew was in there filming the post game, and I actually asked them to send it to me so I can reflect upon what I said. And you know, I think for me as a coach, the reason why I enjoy coaching is to give back to this wonderful game and to help these young professionals that want to achieve some of the things I was fortunate enough to achieve. And so the first thing I said was, when we win games, you know, I'm not happy for me, and I'm happy to see the smiles on your faces because all the work that you put in is validated with this result, with this performance. And the same when we lose, it's not like I'm upset for me. I'm upset because you guys let yourselves down from a high standard that you guys set early on in the season. And I said, just watching this game from the sidelines, I'm telling you, the energy wasn't there. The commitment to defending wasn't there. We had guys walking on the field. And if we want to be a top team, we have to be operating in all facets of the game, whether it's technical execution. But more than anything else, our group is really vibes off one another when the mentality's right. And so the challenge I pose to the guys is, there should be no one walking tomorrow on the field. No goal kicks, no throw-ins. No, you're either jogging or you're sprinting. And we want to get after the ball, and we want to put pressure on the ball, and we want to play our football regardless of who our opponent is. And I said, I guarantee you, if you do that, you'll put forth a performance that you'll be proud of. Now, the result, you can't control. There's so many factors that go into that. But I could just tell in the pregame that the guys' eyes, the players, they were locked in, and you knew it was going to be a good performance. And, you know, all guys that I thought struggled against Portland came up trumps against LA. So it was a really great performance. And then again, after the game, just reinforced the fact that when we play like this, yeah, we're going to all make mistakes. It's not a problem. But our reactions were great when we made mistakes. If one guy got beat, the next guy was there. Our playing between the lines was really good. And then the one thing, if there's anything that we were a little bit short on was the final product. But again, with Andres out, with Chicho out, you know, those games sometimes come down, and it did to set piece for us. So really proud of the performance last night.
You mentioned Chicho here, and I want to ask you to rehash what you've already said publicly about the absence. I'll refer folks back to the MLS statement as well as Real Salt Lake statement. But I do want to talk about what it means for your team and the nitty-gritty of the day-to-day in the next month or so. It feels like here you have struck me as a person ever since I've chatted with you, known you, who wants to be emotionally turned on to your surroundings. How does this Arango news and his absence affect the group? Like, is he in the building at all? How are you managing this as a staff, as a team, just as a group of people?
Yeah. You know, he's not in the building. And that's where I have to be more engaged with the group and kind of, you know, whilst I can't be on the field, making sure, you know, because Chicho does a good job of leading through his actions, right? And in trainings, he's there and he's talking to the guys and he's really, you know, helping Nelson and Ojeda and talking about his movements and where he likes to receive the ball. And so I think I have to kind of take over that aspect of it whilst Jake comes back out of the fray. Who's also one of the leaders. You know, Pablo Ruiz is one of those leaders. So we're missing quite a few guys, and I feel like this is the right time for me to be more present in that regard. And again, just to maintain the standards, but it's difficult. But what I always think about when you lose players, especially important players, is that I always like to look at who fills the void, like who steps up in the absence of someone. Because again, some big personalities occupy a big space in the room. And sometimes when that exists, it's very difficult to see even a young player like Luna maybe step up and be more vocal, be more engaged in the training session, be more engaged in the video session. So that's kind of what I'm looking towards in his absence. And hopefully we can keep the standard high so that when he does come back into the group, you know, we'll pick up where we left off. He's got a program that he's working on, you know, in the gym where he's doing a lot of fitness work, doing a lot of weight work, and so that he comes back and he feels really good about himself from a physical perspective and can just integrate with the group when he gets back.
Of course, Arango will not be back for Rocky Mountain Cup, 9:30 p.m. Eastern, MLS Season Pass on Apple TV. I said it, it's the game of the weekend for me. It decides the cup. This has been a cup dominated by Real Salt Lake since really the first 2 years of this rivalry, and it's such an interesting one through your eyes. You captained Colorado to an MLS Cup. You are part of the sparking of this rivalry, let's call it. You coached the Rapids. Now you're on the other side. I want a memory, a favorite moment from both perspectives, Pablo. Give me a Colorado memory and give me an RSL one that are special to you.
The Colorado memory was, I forget what year it was. It must have been somewhere around 2006 maybe with Dave Checkitz. And he was the owner. And over the years working now at RSL, have become really good buddies with Dave Checkett's son, Spence, who's a big voice in the soccer space, has a show on ESPN, and I chat with him weekly. And we talk about this quite a bit. And it was a game where I was being heckled by the fans at Rice Eccles, and they were giving it to me for 90-plus minutes. And they were – some of the stuff they were saying was borderline. And I took that as an F moment. You know, I'm gonna all right. And at the time, I think I was playing center back. But after that game, I took off my shirt, and I was stuffing it in my shorts saying, "We got you in our pockets." And Dave Checkers didn't like the mannerisms, didn't like that I was – and obviously he had no context to why. It wasn't just like I was just – it was just a spirited game. I just felt abused out on the field. And so this was my moment to kind of get back at the fans, and he didn't like it. So we kind of went chest to chest. And, again, he's like 6'4". He's a monster of a man. And in that moment, I had no fear. Adrenaline was pumping. And I remember Clint Mathis stepping in between the two of us. And Clint and I were roommates with the national team. And he's like, "Pablo, you don't want any of this." And I was like, "Yeah, you're – you know, when Clint said that, I kind of looked up. And I was like, "Yeah, you're probably right. I don't want any of this." But I think that was a really powerful moment. And it sparked, obviously, the next – Rocky Mountain Cup, and it was in both teams' minds as to how it went down. And I think for me, it was really last year where, you know, we came here towards the end of the season, and I think the Rocky Mountain Cup was already solidified at that point. But I had probably 30 friends and family at the game, and my kids, who I don't see as often as I'd like, and they brought their significant others. And after the game, I jumped up in the stands with my family and just spent time with family and friends and just kind of relishing in the moment of how crazy life is, how much time we spent in you know, Dick's Sporting Goods Park for all these years. And here I am on the other side and enjoying a moment with my family who still lives in Colorado after a very hard-fought victory. So I'd say those two moments probably resonate the most.
That is a special full circle moment. As you're telling that story, I'm thinking about a question here that I like to ask people. That I think just whether it's a soccer coach, a player, somebody you meet on the street, whatever. Who's your best friend in, let's just say, the world, Pablo? Who's your best friend?
My wife. My wife is my best friend. And we started dating. I was 16. She was 14. And so we grew up together. And one of the great things about having my girlfriend at the time, but now my wife, is oftentimes I see in professional sports when guys, you know, find their significant others when they've already started their career, there's a lack of knowledge as to how much you have to sacrifice your personal life to be involved in professional sports at any level, whether it's front office, whether it's a player, whether it's a kit man, whether it's a trainer. I mean, you literally give your life to the game. And he had to pursue what I enjoy in life whilst staying in Colorado, seeing the kids through high school, which is a really powerful thing. And I think only a best friend, not necessarily a wife, but a best friend is the only person that would be able to do that.
Hear, hear, man. Preach on that one. Having a good partner is, it is a hack in life. I'm very thankful to have one myself. How about your partner on the other sideline? Chris Armas, what do you think of the job he's done this year with this Rapids team?
He's done an amazing job. You know, Chris was a mentor for me with the national team. You know, he was the guy that had that position locked down. And I'd ask him all kinds of questions about the positioning, how he goes about thinking about the game, how he prepares for games. And so I was picking his brain as a young player. And unfortunately, he tore his ACL going into, I think, 2002, which then opened up an opportunity for me. and obviously been following his coaching career, and he's done a really good job. And, you know, at New York, and then obviously a wealth of experience at Man United, which is awesome. And before all the games, we talk, you know, he's like a long lost brother in a lot of ways, where we've never been really, really close, but I always feel really, you know, I feel close to Chris, and we can pick up a conversation where we left off. And, you know, I think what he's done with that, with the group here, has been tremendous. The way they play with his intensity. You know, the tactical part of it is very clean. You know, you could see exactly what they're trying to do. And he's another guy that I think, can reach the souls of the players. You know, when he speaks with conviction, speaks with belief, speaks with experience. And I think the team has followed him to this point, and that's why they are where they are. And Chris Armas has done a great job.
I know the coaches and people don't really like to get involved with sort of the narratives awards side, but I've had people yelling at me this week about Coach of the Year and the right way to judge Coach of the Year. And how can't I put Chris Armas as the Coach of the Year or Dean Smith? And maybe I just have a different viewpoint of it. As a coach, I'm wondering, in your eyes, when you think about the Coach of the Year at the end of the season, what is that coach? Is it the coach that gets the most points, the results, or is it the coach that does the most with the least, et cetera? Like, how do you think about that?
Yeah, I think it'd be a combination of all that, right? But I also, I love an underdog story. And so, like, coaches that weren't even on the radar to start the season. So your preseason coach of the year, they probably have a really established group, a pretty good history. But it's, I also like the coaches that weren't even on the radar, and all of a sudden they're front and center. And both those coaches, you have done a fantastic job. And I think that's what's exciting about when you have coaches that can take teams from anonymity to now being spoken about on a, hey, they're chasing the shield. Hey, they're picked to finish bottom of the West, and now they're climbing to the top or in the East or whatever it is. I think that's a great story as well. So I think, finish well. So points do matter, but I think there's a sliding scale as to how that all fits in. And Andrew, you probably know better than I do how it all works, because I have no idea. But I really think those two coaches have done a fantastic job this year.
I completely agree. I just look at the history of the award. It's often given to the Shield winning coach or very close to it. We'll see. This year, I mean, look, you're playing in that same pin with all the Shield boys. Pablo, RSL is there. Where is this club in its growth cycle? Like, are you trying to fight your way into that group? Do you feel like you're in that group? Where do you see yourself within the league hierarchy right now?
Yeah, no, I think this is the first year where I feel like we as a team, we as a club, feel like we belong. And I couldn't say that the last few years. Obviously, you know, when you bring in a player like Chicho, there's a certain shelf life with how many goals he can score. I think you need a player that is a guy that puts points on the board for you. And then building a really strong group around him is also really important. But I feel it's something that we can now, with our game model and our positional profiles. Again, in the past, I think when we're looking for a player, was like, who's the best player? Not necessarily the one that fits the game model. And I feel like our evolution as a club is now saying, well, this guy's actually really, really good, but he doesn't fit. Because now we need a running 10. We don't need a creative 10. We need a running 10. And so now the focus just goes on that. And I think that's I think the big teams do that, where I think the teams that aren't quite there yet just want to bring in talent. I feel like our roster is talented, and now we can really fine tune position players that we're looking for.
You talked about the 10. It feels like that's the spot that this team wants to reinforce. It's July 18th. I'm looking at the calendar. The transfer window is open. What kind of profile are we talking about for that position? How could that change this team if you can get the job done in the window?
Yeah, no, I think, I think a running 10, obviously, we want quality to handle the ball, but obviously creating space for guys like Chicho and Luna are really important in order to bring out their maximum attributes, like what they bring to our group. And Crooksy has been fantastic for us this year. He was great last night. But have that profile where we want to continue to be vertical. And in order to do that, you have to have a profile of a player that already has that built in. You can't bring in a top player who's creative and ask him to do things that aren't natural to him. And then again, we can then start to rotate between Luna, Crooks, and said player, to really throw different looks at different teams, depending on what, you know, what, how they're setting up. And so, you know, we, you know, those two guys, we've been really fortunate this year that they've been healthy. And oftentimes you think like, oh, they're healthy now, they're going to be healthy forever. My whole thing is always thinking about what happens if. And so I think that profile would definitely suit our group and would make a huge difference. Right now, we've identified a couple. We've talked to a couple, but nothing has solidified. And so we got a lot of work to do. Obviously, this Leagues Cup buys us a little bit of time, but we want to make sure that we have the player in-house at least a couple weeks before we embark on the last part of the season.
I'll just stay tuned to Tom Bogert's Twitter feed. I'm sure I'll find out whenever this transfer does occur. One of those guys in the pocket there that's played so well is Diego Luna. He is making the leap, it seems like. How do you coach him? Because, I mean, I just listened to you talk, and you seem like it's not like a holistic approach. It's an individualistic approach, I feel like, to players and people. How do you coach Diego?
Yeah, I think the one thing is, and what I learned in coaching is, everyone's an individual. And while there's a certain standard and a certain way that we operate as a team, you have to reach each player individually because they're all different. And Diego is a very fiery player. He's got a chip on his shoulder, whether it's game time or 3 o'clock in the morning. Like, he's waking up trying to prove to the world that he is the best. And oftentimes when you're a younger player, you don't express yourself in a way that is commensurate with being more successful. You just express yourself because you want to do it now. And so going from that Portland game, you know, just sitting with him and talking about, well, why are you drifting in the middle in this particular play? He goes, because the space was really tight. And I said, right. So if we're trying to attract numbers ball side, don't you think we can attract more if you stay in the pocket versus drift? Because now you're drifting towards the middle and you're still not an option, right? And so then when we switch, we haven't moved the whole back line across because you're not in that pocket. If you stay in that pocket, the back line has to respect you. And now a center back more than likely will come out into that pocket, which means the weak side center back has to come across. And so with Diego, I'm cognizant of his he wants it right now and he wants to get on the ball now and is still learning about the importance of what his role does for the rest of the group whilst not being the focal point at that moment. And being okay with it, and again, I think that just comes down to experience. And it's been now, you know, 6 months of the same thing, and that's why with development for me, every player learns at different rates. And the most important thing for us, as coaches and as a club, is to have patience. Like it's no different than kids learning in the classroom. It takes time. Some kids get it right away. Some kids take 6 months. Some kids have to be held back a year, and that's okay. Because what he's doing in real time for us has been amazing. And so now we're getting into the finer details. And I think just constant connection with Diego is really, really important. And what I felt with young players is if you don't connect with them on a regular basis, they almost feel like you're giving up on them. Whereas older players don't even want to talk to the coach. Younger players need that constant affirmation that, hey, we're supporting you. We got you. This is okay. No problem. It's going to take some time. Let's just try to, instead of doing it once, let's try to do it twice this game and just have more empathy towards younger players.
I'm thinking, as you described that, about Andres Gomez, excuse me, in his leap, what were the ingredients in your mind leading up to this? Because a breakout year doesn't just like snap your fingers. Oh, we're in the middle of it. Like there's a buildup to that.
Yeah. I think Andres was one of the most talented raw players that I've ever had been able to coach. When he came in last year, what he's doing this year in games, he was doing last year in training. And what really I think helped him this year was understanding the speed of play in our league, understanding that you have to have decisions made before you receive the ball. And because last year as a dribbler, he was making decisions on the run. And so those moments to really penetrate defenses with one touch passes, two touch passes weren't there. And so he was found himself oftentimes dribbling across the field. Where this year, given the way we're playing and him being the stretch and the width on the right side, we've been able to really hit some patterns where if he's receiving it and Crooks is in the half space, depending on the how close the defender is to him, if he's really tight, then we're looking for 1-2s and he's running without the ball. right? If there's space, then we're talking about engage. Can you find Chicho in the nine? Can you find Crooks in the 10? Or can you go 1v1? And so we're just constant repetitions. But I think the biggest thing, Andrew, is, you know, as an attacking player, when you hit the back of the net, when you get your assists per game, you start believing that you're a fantastic player. And then all the work then starts to validate the fact that you are, and he starts to double down on the work. So it becomes this like self-fulfilling prophecy. But he's always been an amazing young talent. And now it's, again, just fine-tuning things that makes him. And for me, he's been, you know, one of the top wingers in this league.
I want to ask you about the U.S. manager situation right now, but I would be killing myself if I didn't ask you about Emeka Anelie. I've talked about him enough. I've tried to hype this dude up. His performance has been so good. As a player, as a person, what is Emeka like, and what developmental moment is he in right now in his career?
Yeah, no, I think, again, Emeka for me is one of the guys that you can build this team around for the next 10 years. He has he's selfless. He's humble in his work. He's one of the few younger players that can take information and deliver it in real time. You know, where that you know, he's one of those A students where he's like sits at the front of the class. He's always engaged. He's taking what you're dropping, and he's picking up everything. And he's and so that's more from like a player perspective. Or a student perspective. From a player perspective, he's nails. He's one of the best players I've seen, along with Nagby, that is just so ball secure. And you can beat the ball into him in a space with three or four guys, and he always comes out with it or definitely protects it. He's got, you know, very good passes between the lines. Defensively, he's just a monster. He understands defending space and man, which is something that we work on incessantly around here, is passing lanes and his close down speed is really good. So he's got all that. The one area of his game I think that we need to continue to work on is his range of passing. And that's something that he works on probably 3 or 4 days a week. But I couldn't be more pleased. And at the moment, where he's at developmentally at the moment is, I think he's hit a bit of a wall, both physically and mentally, because he hasn't been asked to play at this level. You know, and I think he was playing at a 12 for the first, whatever it was, 20 games of the season. And now he's kind of regressed a little bit, both physically, mentally as well, because now the expectations are higher, because everyone thought that maybe he might be an all-star. And so you see how all this stuff starts to weigh on a young player's mind. But he came in last night and played in the right 10, and I thought he did a fantastic job for us. And he's got a final pass. You know, he had a shot on goal that was blocked by a defender real close to the goal. So I think he's in a great way. He can play multiple positions for us in the middle of midfield and right back as well. And that's always worth his weight in gold. But again, I can't say enough about his character as a man. Has a wonderful family who are, you know, just the best, biggest fans of RSL and Emeka. And it's so awesome to see, man.
As a fan of the Super Draft, these are some of my favorite stories about guys who get the opportunity, who wait for the opportunity, who don't have the same path as others, and then thrive. Look, we're looking for as many stories as we can get on that thrive side for the U.S. Men's National Team heading to 2026. You got a long history with the program. I'm curious what you think this group needs or could use in a manager. What would you look for?
I think more than domestic or international, I think it's more about experience. And I think having been in those shoes and understanding that, you know, where I think Greg did a really good job of implementing his principles. And I think that's a big reason why he brought in the same group over and over again, regardless of what their form was with the respective clubs. Developing a really good culture, developing, you know, a game model that was really familiar to the players. But I think now moving forward, I think it's critical that the guys that are in camp are the guys that are in form, right? Having a player that plays in Europe and being excited about that, but he's only a sub for his respective team, I don't think is better than an MLS player. And I could keep throwing this name out, Brian White. And people could say whatever about Brian White, but he is in form. He is scoring goals. He is, and that's what you want for the team. And so now you create this competitive environment. And I remember, you know, when I was with the national team, you know, guys would come into camp, you know, Ricardo Clark, and I'd be like, who's this? And I'm like, okay, now I got to double down on the work that I'm doing because I need to keep my position. And so I think a little bit more competition, and I think that comes from a coach that isn't necessarily, you know, he isn't privy to like the relationships of these players when they were young. He's like saying, I don't really know who you are. I know that you play for a good team, but if you're not playing great, can't have you in this camp, but be ready to come into the next camp because this team here needs to win this game. And the only way we're going to do that is with a good mentality, good culture, and more importantly, picking players that are in form at the moment that are competing at a really high level.
Competitive edge. That's what we're seeing at the top of MLS this year, too. There's a big six. RSL is part of it, 9:30 p.m. Eastern. Rocky Mountain Cup action. Pablo Mastroianni on the sidelines. You can watch MLS Season Pass. Enjoyed the stories, Pablo. Enjoyed the time. It's always a pleasure to chat. I've got to figure out how to read multiple books at once. But other than that, off into the future we go, man.
Awesome, Andrew. Great times, bud.
Oh, my gosh. Just an absolute joy to chat with Pablo about literally anything. I got to get my book reading game up. Before I let you go, though, a big tournament coming up for the U.S. Youth Men's National Team, the U23 team, plus a couple overage players in the Olympics in Paris. It's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. You know how passionate I am about this particular competition and the fact that the U.S. hasn't been in it since 2008. So when I got the opportunity to chat with Marko Mitrovic earlier this week, I had to take it to get myself and you ready for the men's side of the soccer bracket in the Olympics. So take a listen, enjoy, and we'll see you next week, everybody. Adios. It's our pleasure now to welcome the head coach of the men's U23 U.S. men's national team in Paris right now for the Olympics, Marko Mitrovic. Marko, thank you for joining me. How are preparations going? How are you feeling?
Andrew, thank you for having me. Yeah, everything is going well so far. We really have all needed resources here. Great two fields that we're using for our work. Great hotel and everything else that is needed for good preparation. Great weather. So everything is going well so far.
In my collective memory banks, I have three straight large areas of scar tissue with the U.S. men's Olympic team failing to qualify. And you guys got it done. And you're on this stage and you're getting prepared for this tournament. I wonder how this team thinks about this responsibility, this opportunity ultimately to represent the U.S. on what's not the World Cup, but what is a unique, massive stage.
Yeah, I believe we are all aware of that. At the very beginning of the process, we work on that to be sure that everybody knows where we are going. You know, like just in general, like players, staff members, and what kind of the games, what kind of event Olympic Games are. Listen, one thing is watching Olympic Games as a fan, and the other thing is participating there. And like you said, that's a massive honor, but on the other side, it's massive responsibility to do your job in the best possible way. And I think that players are very, very aware of that, and the whole staff, the whole team, actually. And yeah, we know we can know and expect what can happen during Olympic Games and how big event is that.
I want to dig into some specifics on the player side and tactics, what we'll see, et cetera, but let's just keep it broad for now. Americans will watch this and they'll wonder what is success and failure. And for Americans, that's often just very binary. It's winning. For you, as you look at the tournament and you sort of get your guys ready, how do you approach that line between success and failure? Is it just results for this team? Is there something bigger? People talk about player development and, of course, going on to the full national team. What is success for the U.S. in France?
Yeah, I think we are in a high-performance environment where, obviously, we are going to be judged by our final result, you know. And when you talk about Olympics, probably people always connect that with going to the podium. On the other side, we know that this is unique sport on a men's soccer side where you play with under 23s and where we have another obligation to develop players for our MNT. And on one side, competing in the Olympic Games, but on the other side, having some of those guys on the long term being part of MNT. If I talk purely from my personal perspective, I just want us to work as best as possible day after day and game after game. And that's how I see this tournament for us. We have to give everything we have every day in our camp right now. And when we get to Marseille and then we go game by game. How far we're going to go, let's see. But if we give our best, wherever is our final day of the Olympics, we'll be proud on everything we did. And we will know that we did everything.
You have experience at the youth level of winning big tournaments. I mean, a U-20 tournament, the FIFA World Cup for the men's side with Vukov Hanovic, with Serbia. What'd you learn from that particular experience that you can port over here? Are there things that you're saying, okay, we did this, I'm going to do the same thing? Are there things you're saying, okay, we're not going to do that, that didn't actually work?
Yeah, I think that I would say like that. This every group is unique for itself, and every tournament, however, is unique for itself. But as you said, we all learn a lot of things based on our experience. And some things you try to copy paste, some things you say like, oh, this cannot work. And we have experience that this didn't work, you know. But for me, the one, if you speak purely about field and what expectations we can have from our opponents, something that we speak a lot that there is every team is elite team. And when you get to the final stage, there are no easy opponents. And what it means that every moment in a game, in every action, we have to be on our highest level. But however, we have to respect ourselves, because if we believe in ourselves, then we will go to execute these actions on the best possible way. And we will be ready to compete on the highest level. And again, the margins in the tournaments are very small, and those small opportunities that we will get, we have to be ready to use them. And also we have to minimize those small opportunities that for our opponents, because as I said, it's a elite tournament and they will use that. Also something that we speak a lot, that tournaments, one play, one action can determine the whole tournament. And we just have to be sure that we are successful in those moments.
Normal tournaments, you got a bigger squad to lean on. The Olympics are unique, 18 players. I'm sure that math was very difficult for you just from a coaching perspective, let alone an interpersonal perspective. How did you go and approach making an 18-man roster? How is that different than for other tournaments where you have more options? What's the math there? What's the science? What's the emotion? How did you do it?
Yeah, I would say when you have a bigger squad, somehow it's clear and obvious who's going to be on that squad. And you have less players off your roster that maybe we would expect that they are on the roster. Now you get more narrow from 26 to 23 in some tournaments, and then you get to the Olympics, we have 18, 16 field players and two goalkeepers. From very beginning, we had some objectives, how to create that roster. You know, one, it's obviously always go with the quality of the players on the field. You go to multi-positions, what players can play different positions. You try to predict their behavior in a big tournaments, because this tournament is so intense that we have to have also players and staff members that are very committed to the team. Like I said, it's a very short time frame during these tournaments that the only focus we can have is focus on the tournament. And now from each of those brackets, there are so many things that you have to think about, like, okay, if this happens in a game, like what we are doing right now, what resources we have. And sometimes like talking like this, I can talk now for days how that process was I can't say challenging, but it's a very, very holistic approach creating that roster. Because even though that this is, I had already several big tournaments in my coaching career, but I've never been to the Olympics and never had such a small squad of 18 players total.
So people are going to focus on the snubs, obviously, but I want to focus more on the overage side, because that is this unique puzzle you're making. It's not just 18. You also have the option to go out into the wider player pool and grab three guys. when I'm thinking about how you might have made that decision, I'm wondering if you're diving into data. I'm wondering if you're studying previous tournaments to see, like, hey, what was the makeup of successful teams? How did you figure out the profiles you wanted for the overage players, which are Georgi Mihailovic, Walker Zimmerman, and Miles Robinson? And then how did you settle on the individuals themselves?
Yeah, we did that research, a big research on how other teams, successful teams, approach to their Olympic teams, you know? However, I think that every team is unique and every team has different circumstances when you create. And our first thing was, okay, we always have to speak about the quality. So about overage players, but that quality has to go with the needs, positional needs that Olympic age group players maybe, I can't say lack, but we would like to have more there. And then you talk about leadership, you talk about the experience, you talk about having guys that already have experience in major big tournaments, you know, because you want also that your overage players have something behind them and not just having age of playing soccer and then going to the first tournament, because then kind of they're in the same spot where every other player is. And that's something that how we end up the approach to our overage players.
What kind of number 10 is Georgi Mihailovic in your eyes? How does he fit into this team?
Yeah, Georgi is someone that we strongly believe he can change the game going forward. Georgi is proven as someone who has ability to score goals, but also make assists. You know, Georgi is great set pieces taker. The way we want to play with the ball, Georgi has a high technical level and understanding of the game. I had opportunity in my past to work with Georgi, and I actually know very well how talented Georgi is a player. Yeah, it's just watching Georgi, how he integrates with the group and what he brought last 5-6 days for us. Things are going really good.
As far as the back line goes, I think you see a pair of center backs that know each other well. Was that just sort of an idea of like, hey, let's get a head start on a very relationship-based position where we don't have to do maintenance, we don't have to figure this out. These guys know each other. It's a foundation. Build it. Let's go.
Yes, that's correct. Because even though that we speak about 9 or 10 months of this process, like actually we work on only 30 days within this 9-10 months. And I think that all the relationship that are already built in the past help for our future. And Walker and Miles play so many games together with our MNT. They know each other very, very good. They are quite complementary, a pair of center backs. And they have support for Maxi Dietz in that position also, because we strongly believe in Maxi and Maxi's talented potential to play for MNT one day. And they're going to be great mentors for Maxi for his future as well.
What do you expect from them leadership-wise? Like you mentioned guys that have already been in tournaments. How does that actually manifest itself within your team?
Yeah, it's just, listen, there is one uncertainty when you go to tournament. Like, what's that? How that looks like, you know? But when you've been there, it just, you don't have that uncertainty. You have expectations. And that's something that I believe they all bring with them. So, like, and not just our guys that are Olympic age group players, it's all in every other team, that uncertainty and youngness, like that will appear there. And these guys, that's the moment where they have to step up, obviously together with the staff, and just support those players, believe in them, giving them the right advices, just not verbally, but by actions also. You know, and that's, like I said, that uncertainty that a lot of players will have, they're not going to have that because they will have expectations.
Do you have any uncertainty, Marco, when it comes to the starting goalkeeper position? Like, do you know who your guy is right now who will start against France?
Yes.
Who is that guy?
We'll talk about when the game comes.
Will there be rotation or is it, hey, I have one guy, this is the guy, that's who will be throughout the tournament if they're available?
You talk about goalkeeper position?
Yes.
We'll see. It's a tournament. However, if we speak about goalkeepers, one thing that we have to know, we have 6 days guaranteed. 6 days. You know, when you talk about a long season, that's something in a club, for example, environment, that's something that, or even in international environment, but when it's a long process, you want to be challenged. You want to challenge your players with competition because that helped them to grow. But when you get to such a short tournament, we talk about support as well. Everybody has to be ready to play, but also everybody has to understand his role on the team and to support player that is on the field in that moment.
Makes sense to me. Up top, what is Duncan McGuire's role? Is it to play 270 minutes? Because when you look at the roster and you don't see a bunch of nines floating around, you see some nine adjacent players that could play it in a different way. Do you expect Duncan, it's like, hey, this is your job, go get it, go play all these minutes, or does somebody else have to be ready to step in?
When we played the game so far, we were preparing also to play without classic forward, if I can say. And the way we play, it's usually you go for subs in your front lines. So, I mean, I can't say now from this moment, Duncan will play in 270 minutes, but it doesn't look that possible for me.
What is his strength, do you think, in this team? Why was he the nine that you chose?
Yeah, Duncan is, I think he has second good season in MLS. Duncan can score the goals. Duncan is very, very hardworking player. Someone that from day one understood the way we want to play, fit great with this team. And yeah, we believe in Duncan. We trust Duncan. And hopefully he will, we believe actually that he will bring a lot of happiness.
Marco, before we go, people will be watching this team for the first time. The rest of us sickos out there that have been following the process and hoping, praying to see the U.S. men in Olympics will know. Can you just tell people who turn it on against France for the very first time, what image do you have in your mind? How do you want to see your team play? What is the, I mean, game model is sort of overused, but when you see this team play, match one in your mind, what do you see?
This one thing is, listen, no matter what's the opposition, there is the different resistance on the field that opposition gives you. And this is the thing that you don't control. What you control is your energy, your enthusiasm, your passion, and your willingness to give everything for this crest. And that's something that I promise everyone, this group is ready. That's what we control, and that's what's going to be there every game with a lot of intensity, like I said, with a lot of passion, with a lot of energy, with a lot of braveness and respect towards ourselves first. That's going to be our team in the Olympic Games.
What do you imagine when you step on that field against France? Because it's not, you know, every first Olympic game is different, is special. But to do it against the host nation is sort of a different honor for this U.S. team, and certainly given their talent, a different challenge.
Yeah, I'm very aware of that event, if I can say. Like, it's almost the first event in the Olympics, in the Olympic Games. And like I mentioned many times, the Olympic Games officially starts 2 days after our game. And knowing how big is soccer in France and just generally around the world, and then hosting team playing that game, there's going to be a lot of people watching that game. And it's great experience for all of us in this environment. However, we just want to be sure that we don't start and end up Olympic Games with that game, no matter what's the outcome of that game. We have two more games. And yes, it's great honor. Like I said, we are aware of that event, but that's not just an only event for us in the Olympic Games.
All right, chasing the podium, chasing, representing the U.S. well on a big stage I haven't been since 2008, Marco Mitrovic and this U.S. U23 team. You can watch the first game on Wednesday, July 24th against France. New Zealand and Guinea are the other teams in the group with the U.S. Marco, thanks for your time, man. Appreciate you.
Thank you. Thank you. Have a great one. We'll be right back.